All right. Good morning, everybody. Happy Friday. Welcome to the April 25th, 2025 Santa Ana Water Board meeting. We are meeting in person and via Zoom, and this meeting is being webcast and recorded. For those who have completed a virtual speaker card for this Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting or exit the meeting at that time. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. And now I'll ask our board members to please introduce themselves, and I will start with board member Al Lopez.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Al Lopez. I'm the former mayor and councilman of the city of Corona, and also a longtime member of Western Municipal Water District in Riverside County.
Thank you. Board member Gloria Alvarado.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the beautiful city of Santa Ana, my hometown.
Nice.
Thank you.
And board member Letitia Clark.
Good morning, everyone. Letitia Clark, former mayor and council member in the city of Tustin. It's nice to be here in Santa Ana. This is actually my first time in the city hall after growing up here in Orange County, so it's a treat. Thank you.
Thank you. And board member William Rue.
Good morning. I am Bill Rue, a council member in the city of Montclair, California, where I'm a lifetime resident. And welcome. We appreciate the efforts by the city of Santa Ana to provide this space for us today.
Thank you. And Vice Chair John Scandura.
Good morning. I'm John Scandura. I've lived in the Santa Ana region most of my life. I was born and raised in the Inland Empire. I'm a graduate of UCI, and I've lived in Huntington Beach for the last 3 decades. So thank you. And again, thank you to the city of Santa Ana for hosting us.
And good morning, everyone. My name is Chris Murray. I'm chair of the board and former mayor pro tem and councilwoman for the city of Anaheim, and like my colleagues, have served and lived most of my life in this region, and we're all here and honored to serve you as representatives of our board and agency. With that, I would like to move on to our public forum. Do we need to do... Sorry, there was a little notation there. I want to make sure we're on track. So item two is our public forum. Any person may address the Santa Ana Water Board on any matter within the board's jurisdiction, provided that the matter does not appear elsewhere on the agenda and has not been scheduled to appear on a future agenda and is not otherwise pending before the board. We welcome hearing from the public at this meeting. So if you've submitted a speaker card, for those items listed on today's agenda, you will make your comments at the time the item is being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum, and comments will be limited to 3 minutes. Jessica, do we have any speaker cards at this time? There she is.
We have one speaker on Zoom who signed up, Ellen Lee. She didn't indicate a number. So, Ellen, did you want to speak at public forum?
Hello?
Hello, Ellen, we can hear you.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Would you like to speak now, or do you want to speak to another item on the agenda?
Yeah, first time join, so I want to just listening today, yeah.
Okay, so no public comments at this time?
Yes, no.
Okay, well, thank you. We welcome you to listen into the meeting, and please let our clerk know if you have an item you would wish to speak to. So with that, no others at this time, Jessica?
No others.
Okay, great. Then we'll move on to item three, this item is our State Water Resources Control Board liaison report, where the State Water Board will provide an update on their activities. And I'd now like to introduce Vice Chair of the State Water Resources Control Board, Doreen Didi Diamo, who will provide her update. And Didi, the floor is yours.
Good morning. Good morning to all of you, Madam Chair, members of the board, and good morning, Santa Ana. I'll start off with an update on our strategic work plan, which is something that we review and discuss any changing priorities. Usually we do this in January, but we had a bit of a delay this year. And so we received an information item to discuss the strategic work plan and discuss any changes at our March meeting. And the strategic work plan, I'm happy to say, you know, we really do. I think this is an opportunity for us to be accountable as to our priorities from the year before and see whether or not we've achieved those specific action items and make any adjustments. We maintain our four thematic priorities. Under the strategic plan, protecting public health by ensuring reliable access to safe, affordable drinking water and sanitation, protecting and restoring watersheds, marine waters, and ecosystems, increasing statewide water resilience in the face of climate change and other threats by expanding and integrating our water supply portfolio in California. And then lastly, something that I know we're all, it's a newer action item or theme for us, but that is focusing on strengthening relationships, systems, and internal capacity in a way that we are able to accomplish our mission strategically, transparently, equitably, and efficiently. The updated draft work plan has been posted to our website. Also, at our March meeting, we did receive an update on our racial equity action plan. We have 53 specific actions that have been prioritized for the last 2 years, and we receive an annual update on our action plan and the progress on implementation. And this has been a great opportunity. We set aside a fair amount of time and hear from all the divisions that are working on this and more in-depth information about progress and some of the challenges that they're seeing in moving forward and meeting our goals under the action plan. Also, last month, we had a round of stakeholder meetings through the Division of Administrative Services. The stakeholder meetings were focused on the annual fees and any adjustments, increases to fees for water rights, water quality, drinking water, and the environmental lab accreditation program. This is something that we do each year, have a series of stakeholder meetings. This is an opportunity for stakeholders to sort of anticipate, even if we don't have all the information just yet, which we didn't end up in March, waiting for the May revise as the budget discussions continue at the legislature. The next round of stakeholder meetings is June 10th and 11th, and then there'll be a final round at the end of July, wrapping up some of the discussions and being better prepared for when the item comes before us in September under our emergency rulemaking authority. Shifting focus here to urban stormwater infiltration, on March 12th, our staff conducted a public scoping meeting under CEQA for the proposed urban stormwater infiltration water quality control policy that will be setting statewide standards for urban stormwater infiltration, which is something that I know we share this goal with the regional boards, really seeking to see more of urban stormwater infiltration as part of the water resilience and expansion of water supplies in California. Public comments on the draft supplemental environmental document were due on March 31st. At our second meeting in March, we had a public hearing to receive oral comments on the 2026 integrated report draft 303D list for that report and including the draft staff report. On January 30th, we released the, our staff released the draft for your 3D list and the staff report for public comment. And the public comment period closed on April 2nd. We will be considering adoption of the proposed 2026 303D list at a subsequent board meeting in early 2026. The Division of Water Rights Bay Delta Program Unit has been busy with some additional work meetings that were held between January 16th and March 4th to receive further input on the draft Sacramento Delta updates to the water quality control plan for the San Francisco-Sacramento Delta watershed. The comments, the public draft was released in October of last year, and we had many workshops and then really drilling down on some of the specific key issues of concern with more targeted technical meetings, six meetings that were held earlier this year. The working meetings were really intended to allow some time for technical dialogue between staff and participants that will help to inform our board and our staff as we work toward a revised draft of the proposed updates. So stay tuned. Hopefully by the time I talk with you, meet with you next, I'll have more information that I can provide on schedule. Now focusing on the utility wildfire general order. On March 28th, our staff released proposed revisions to a draft that had been released in June of last year. Staff held a workshop on the 23rd, and the additional 30-day public comment period will close, actually in a few days here, on the 29th. More information, actually a lot of information, is available on our 401 Water Quality Certification and Wetlands Program website. And at that on that website, there's a lot of information, including, I think, some helpful documents that have a red line between the current draft and the prior draft, as well as a comparison between the two drafts, which should help to facilitate information for the public comment period. The anticipated date for consideration of adoption is later this year. Our administrative hearings office continues its important work on two key petitions, the Delta Conveyance Project, which those hearings resumed earlier this month, and then the Sites Project Authority. The hearings office has concluded the evidentiary portion of the hearing for Sites Water, for the Sites Project, with the focus at this point shifting to a closing brief schedule. So definitely moving along with respect to both of those items. I'm not able to say more because we're under ex parte restrictions, but did want to provide an update on process for those two important petitions. And then lastly, I really look forward to seeing as many of you that are able to attend our annual Water Quality Coordinating Committee. This is our annual meeting that we hold in conjunction with regional boards. It's a public meeting, and so the public is welcome to follow along our discussions. This is really a chance for us to engage informally with state board and regional board, and also to have some important targeted discussions. These meetings have been occurring since the adoption of the Porter-Cologne Water Quality Act since it went into effect in 1970. And it's just really been, I think for me, a great opportunity to engage more directly with regional boards that I am a liaison to, and of course, all the regional boards, and as well, hopefully for you all that are able to attend as well. If you're not able to attend, there's an opportunity to attend virtually as well. I'll just quickly go through the agenda to just pique your interest here. On day one, we'll be receiving updates from the governor's office, California Environmental Protection Agency, and the Office of Chief Counsel. And then we'll focus on two key areas, subject area matters, on budget and then harmful algal blooms. And that's on day one. Also on day one and on day two, we're going to be receiving, this is my favorite part, we receive updates from the regional boards. Usually the regional boards will focus on a key or several key briefly items that they just want to highlight for state board and for all regional boards. And I just find that day to be, or those updates to be very informative. And then on day two, we'll be hearing, I'm not sure exactly what, but very interested in hearing about tools and approaches for making difficult decisions. That's one subject. And the second is on wastewater needs assessment. I'm really excited about this area as well, because we have an annual needs assessment for drinking water, and that tool has been really helpful as we make decisions on allocations of funds, and now working on a similar tool for wastewater needs assessment. And I know that's an area that the regional boards have been very engaged in. So looking forward to the discussion there. The dates, I should have mentioned this earlier, May 1st and May 2nd. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before you this morning.
Thank you so much, always, for your thorough reports. Do we have any questions or comments from the board? Board Member Ruth?
Yes. I appreciate WQCC, what it does. I will, unfortunately, this is one I've, very few I've missed. I will have to miss that one, although I'll be in Sacramento that week. I will be there for a professional conference, and I'm probably not able to break free for the meetings, but they're great, and I look forward to the next one that I can attend. Thank you.
I'm sorry, we're going to miss you. I always enjoy, you've had great attendance, and it's always good to see you at the meetings, board member, and I'm sorry about the schedule. I know we've had some schedule conflicts with other board members as well.
Thank you so much, and please give everyone our best up there who've working so hard on making that a productive time for all of the statewide officers. Well, thank you, Dee Dee. We appreciate your time and wish you a very happy weekend, and thank you again for your thorough report.
Thank you.
We'll move now to item four on racial equity, where Santa board staff will provide an update on our racial equity activities in our region. And I'd like to ask our executive officer, Jane Joy, to present her update and report.
Hi, good morning. Good. Sorry, I have a little bit of a scratchy throat. I will do my best. I'm here to give the update for the racial equity item and the work I'm very proud of. It's been a good journey. For me personally, and as well as our office. As you recall, in had our July meeting in the 24 July, we had a board meeting. I talked about our racial equity action plan. So it's almost been a year now, and all the items and how it was going to be. The item we've taken our strategic objectives and turned them into actions. And so we walked through some of that, and I'm going to just cover where we are today on a few items. If we can go to the next slide. Forgive me. So these are the four strategic objectives that were identified in the racial equity resolution, as well as in the action plan. And the action plan added goals and tasks to these items. And I'm going to be covering the strategic objective one, which is integrating racial equity measuring impact, infusing the racial equity resolution through the Santa Ana Ward's board's policies, programs, and practices, measuring progress towards goals and adapting when necessary. And also I'll talk about our actions on strategic objective two, which is creating and maintaining spaces for inclusion and belonging, addressing internal and external representation of the Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities within the Santa Ana Water Board, and evaluating overall understanding of racial equity. And these strategic objectives are relatively consecutive, meaning that we do objective one and then move to objective two and objective three and then four. There is some overlap, but they do build on each other. Next slide. And so just talking through the, I would go over these five actions that we've taken over the past year. And I want to just highlight, we have a racial equity team that they have been involved since the beginning, and they helped to write the resolution, they helped to write the action plan. It's really been several of the same team members. It's a cohesive group, a very passionate group, very educated group. We've trained ourselves in learning, and they have some wonderful ideas. And they also become a resource for the rest of our staff. So as we have new staff come in, we have those that can teach them about how it's like a shift. We're shifting our public outreach and internal actions to make sure we're all aware and we have equality within our office and also within our work and our performance of our work. So I'm really proud of this group, and I'm proud of the thoughts and ideas that come out of them. It's just some examples of what they're working on office-wise is they make sure that we have the tools in place to execute our program. We have our data, we have our tools, we have our GIS tools to look at where our communities are and where concerns are. They update our website, make sure that we're communicating effectively, and then we're also looking into using social media. We have determined that we will be using the State Board social media program, and we've initiated using that when we do recruitments, but we're going to expand that and begin to put our public notices through the social media sites and also any other information items that we have. So that's our team. I'll talk a little bit about our public outreach. Again, this has been the main area of a focus for us in just trying to make sure we're hearing the quiet voices that are within our region. And so we've developed materials, we've interacted with our communities, we've tried several things, and what we've really found is that we go and we participate in local activities. We set up a table, we have our fact sheets, we've done it quite a bit with the MS4 permit, Municipal Separate Storm Sewer Permit. Just to make sure we get the word out that, hey, this is what we're working on now and if there's interest. And so that has been happening. We've been reaching out to our tribes. We have a concise list of the tribes that are within our community, and we've learned how to prepare the proper letters and who to send those letters to within the tribe. It's real important to make sure that we're talking to them on a government level at the right level. So we've learn that, and then I also said we're participating in local events. And out of that and some of those efforts, we have connected with others. And this has been kind of an exciting part for me personally, too, is I'm going to mention four agencies that we've been working with. And the groups that have come out of when we've posted our resolution, when we posted our action plan, and they actually came to me. The first one is Maria Kennedy. Actually, Board Member Lopez introduced me to Maria Kennedy. She has been involved in our region for a long time working on septic to sewer projects. We've had some really good, successful projects within the Inland Empire, and they're difficult projects, they're expensive, but they are so beneficial to protecting our groundwater. She called me, Maria called me, it's probably been 2 months now, and asked about identifying some new areas that we could look into in the Inland Empire to see if we can convert their septics to sewer. And I definitely yes, but it has to start with us working with those communities, working with those cities, to see if this is something they would really desire. And so we'll take that initial step and begin working that system. The couple of the sites that she identified were in some of our key groundwater basins, so there's a clear nexus here that I would like to pursue. And I do think I think the homeowners will be pleased with a sewering system, but we'll make sure that we're not telling them what they want. We want to make sure that they understand and desire it. So will take that initial step. The other group that we work very closely with is the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority. And Jeff Mosher's here, and he's going to give an update on our program. They are just so instrumental in helping us get our work across and communicate within our community. They have been such a wonderful support. In relationship to racial equity, they have received a grant. It's the Santa Ana Watershed Climate Adaptation and Resilience Plan. CARP is the acronym. And Jeff is going to go through that in his presentation. But we look forward to partnering with them on that grant effort. The third area is of agency I want to bring up is the Riverside County Flood Control District. They have reached out to me with some initial work that they want to do along the Santa Ana River. And it's looking at multiple beneficial uses along the river to protect water resources, but also to serve the community, provide parks and recreation that's free for some of the community members, but with the intention of looking at key areas to protect water quality. Riverside floods, they manage the stormwater, so they want to make sure that it's protected. And it's just started conceptual. It looks like a fantastic opportunity for us to get involved and engaged and support. And then lastly, I wanted to talk about Pomona College. Again, because we posted our resolution, Professor Heather Williams reached out to me and said, hey, can we work together and do something with our students? Our students are interested in what you're doing. And I was excited, and I said yes. And I'll talk a little bit about that next after I get through the last two bullets. But that has been a really wonderful connection. As far as our tribal plan and our engagement plan, both our racial equity action plan and also included within our triennial review and our list of areas that we need to work on, we want to develop a tribal engagement plan. And this will ultimately result in beneficial uses being identified in our basin plan and possible designations of tribal beneficial uses on certain water bodies. So that work has been initiated. Claudia's here. She's the one who manages our basin plan and has been connecting with the tribes. We send out several letters. We have about 25 tribes or so within our region. Two of them reached back, and we had some great conversations about what we're trying to do and where we're headed. That program has just started. It's going to take a little bit of time. But I do think that we have a couple of tribes that are interested in working with us. So we'll make that happen. And then the last area is recruitment. We have made some strides in recruitment. It's always been a little bit of struggle for us in recruitment and how we reach out to candidates for our positions. Brian Covalone has been really instrumental in working with the city of Riverside. For the last 3 years, he's set up recruitment days, and he's worked with other agencies like DTSC and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and it's like a career day. We go and you meet with the students to explain what we do. In Riverside, there's geologists and engineers and scientists, environmental scientists, that would be good candidates for our work. Those have been very excellent opportunities with quite a bit of really positive feedback from the students. And next slide. But my favorite one so far is working with Pomona College. It was just, when Heather called me, she was just looking for opportunities for her students to know kind of what to expect once they graduate, what kind of jobs they could do. The Pomona College, the students are primarily have political science majors or sociology type majors, but they have a real strong interest in racial equity and water quality and that nexus there. And so we had a really great conversation. So we decided to meet and see if we could create some opportunities for the students to work with us kind of learn what it means to do a job that requires some kind of analysis for racial equity, for public outreach. And so we had this charter. We needed to come up with ideas that would be last from January to April. So it's a real, in water board time frame, that is like a minute. But we did come up with these three areas to work on. And they did, it was just a fantastic job. The first one is the tribal history. Our basin plan currently has a history of the Santa Ana River, but it starts with the settlements. It doesn't discuss the tribes. It doesn't discuss the earlier history, which is a real deficit, and that was identified early on when we did our racial equity action plan. So Dr. Rajan worked with several of the students to identify and work on and compile the history of our river, and they did a fantastic job. It's pretty thorough. They've done a lot of, with a lot of the resources that we have, and it's a good starting place to help to define and begin to write some final language for that basin plan. And, you know, in the short time that they had, I was really pleased with that effort. It's still a work in progress. It's not ready to be a basin plan, but it definitely gave us some history. And this is before the dams were built, and the river system was completely different. Santa Ana River flowed, and it was a braided system that flowed and flooded the entire area. So it was it's just, you know, it's like a different world than it is today. So it was very interesting in that vein. The other area is we were, Michael Jones was working on a river walk, planning a river walk, and this was designed to be in partnership with a tribe where we would walk the river and then the tribe would explain their experiences with the river, their cultural practices, and what they do. And we had a tribe before when we were determining to work on this. Unfortunately, that tribe had to step back due to resource constraints. So we're still looking for another tribe. However, Michael did meet with the students. They were able to identify what are the nuts and bolts to do a walk. Do we need access, you know, accessibility issues? Do we need permits? Do we need, you know, a lot of those logistic things? So there was some benefit, but we haven't stopped thinking about doing a river walk. We have currently sent out emails requesting for another tribe to support us. So we're still having hope that will happen. And the last one is the career path. And we had Brian Covalone do a career day with the students, similar to what he has done with the University of Riverside. This was a fantastic event. It happened on April 15th. And again, one of the things that came out was, you know, these students are not our typical staff. We have engineers, geologists, environmental scientists. These are students that have political science, sociology, bachelor's of arts degrees, a little bit different than what we're accustomed to. And so you know, Brian and I put our heads together and identified four people that have those backgrounds and have successful careers. And so April 15th, we did a Zoom meeting, and our first speaker was Jennifer Nguyen. She was an environmental program manager with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and she works on cannabis, and she has a broad brush of experience. The other person was Noah Sherman. He is an information officer, also with California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And then we also asked Adriana Rentario to speak. She's the Director of Public Engagement, Equity, and Tribal Affairs up at the State Board level. I have worked with Adriana and her staff over the years to get our racial equity program in place, and so she provided. And then best of all was Letitia Clark. Board Member Clark came and spoke, and she gave her history, which is, if you don't know her background and her path, it is fascinating. I just really appreciate your time, and I know it's precious, but it was really valuable and well-received. It was on a Zoom call, and there was about 10 students, so but it was recorded, and then it was distributed to the others that were not able to make it at that time. But it was really a great event. And if you could take down the slide, we do have, I think we have two. You can just take down the presentation. I think we have two of the students that are on the call. I don't know if we can bring them up. I'm going to put them on the spot. Callie Johnson and Faith Henderson were two of the students that we worked with. I don't know if they're willing to turn their cameras on. And can you introduce yourselves and maybe say what your degree is? And if you have a few comments, or if you don't, that's okay. I don't want to put you, but I am putting you on the spot.
Oh, no worries. Hi, everyone. My name is Faith Henderson. I'm an environmental analysis student at Pomona College. I am concentrated in sustainability in the built environment, and just wanted to say thank you so much for having us here today and for giving us a little bit of your time. Yeah, we've been working with the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Board, and it's been a pretty amazing experience for us. We've had the opportunity to do some pretty important research that we feel is pretty fulfilling, and then also, yes, the career panel was definitely a highlight. It was super beneficial for us, and we think it will be beneficial for students, other students as well. And so it's definitely something that we would like to continue to do in the future and years to come, even after we graduate. So yeah, I'll turn it over to Callie so she can do an introduction as well.
Thanks, Faith.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for having us. I'm Callie Johnson, also majoring in environmental analysis with a focus on sustainability in the built environment. I actually go to Scripps College, but I'm majoring at Pomona. Working with the Water Quality Board has been such a great experience, and I feel like it's really prepared me to go into the workforce, and I'm excited for the next steps. The education from this experience has been really nice. Looking at both tribal and ecological history of the Santa Ana watershed. So I've definitely learned a lot about this area, and it was a good way to close my college experience, I think.
Excellent. Thank you. I appreciate you guys speaking. We had a very good experience, and I hope it does continue as well. And that's my report. Any questions?
Thank you so much. Do we have any questions for Jane? Vice Chair Scandura?
Okay, we'll have a comments and then a couple questions. First of all, Jane, thank you for the racial equity report, and it's great to know that racial equity is alive and well here in the Santa Ana region as well as our other eight regional boards. I'm also very pleased to see that we're working with Pomona College. The Santa Ana region is blessed to have some very fine colleges, go Anteaters, and a group of those colleges is the Claremont Colleges, of which Scripps and Pomona are part of that. They are some of the most prestigious schools in the country. Pomona College happens to be one of its selectivity is right up there with the Ivy League schools. So we're definitely working with not only some top-notch professors, but some of the best and brightest students in the country. And we just saw two of them here. And so I'm really looking forward to the products that they're coming up with, the history, the tribal history in the Santa Ana region. And then the Riverwalk planning, that's something that's going to be happening soon.
Yes, we hope this year. Yeah,
okay.
We hope this year, if we just need to find a tribe or an alternative way to make it happen. We're working on it.
Okay, yeah. So definitely I'd love to participate in that walk, although I do have one small request, and that is we might want to avoid the summer.
Okay,
The memory of that Norton Air Force Base meeting in early September at 110 degrees was a little much. So anyway, but I'm looking forward to that.
We'll avoid the heat, yes. Yes, we can do that.
Thank you, Vice Chair Scandura. Board Member Clark?
I'd love to say something. Jane, thank you for that great report. It's just so exciting to see how far the racial equity resolution has come, but really credit to you and your team for being so thorough in the action plan, because it definitely ensures that we're going to see the impact on this organization for years to come. And it also demonstrates that it wasn't just semantics, it wasn't just, words on paper, but it's going to be a living, breathing document. And the fact that you're, talking about new people coming in and then introducing them to the racial equity work just shows that it's going to permeate throughout the organization, even, beyond your years and beyond the team's years. So it's just great to hear that. And then I just want to thank you for the opportunity to serve on the panel. I got goosebumps hearing from the students. Both of those students reached out after the panel on LinkedIn. And to me, this is just what all of this is all about reaching out to the community. And when I first got appointed, I really wanted to figure out how to connect more with the community in layman's terms, essentially helping the community understand what this board does and what this organization does and how it impacts their daily lives. And I feel like with career panels like this, it really touches, you know, the people that we're trying to touch. So it's just sure great to be a part of. And very encouraging to hear these students where they plan to go. Also from the other speakers, it's a reminder that careers aren't linear always. You know, it can be very windy. And, you know, you can major in something, but then work in a totally different field. And so it's all about exposure and just knowing what's out there and what's available and trying the new things while, you know, preferably while you're young and you have the flexibility to do so. So I think the students got all of those nuggets during our panel. So thank you again for the opportunity. And just it's great to hear about all the great work. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate that.
And Board Member Lopez?
I was just going to ask the question, do they receive some kind of a certificate or letter or something? Because, you know, young people, they love to add those things to the resumes, you know, when they apply for...
It's on my list. It'll be done Monday.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We can definitely do that. We can definitely make that happen.
Thank you.
Yes. Board Member Alvarado.
And if I can make it the request that perhaps they are presented during a board meeting, that we all get to meet them, and also the public gets to meet them and see the accomplishment that has been done. And again, just thank you for all the work, and thank you to all the participants for being interested in. And I heard sustainability a couple of times. That is so important. This is the future, so thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jane, for your work. And it's just clear how joyful you are about it and how much integrity you bring to it, that you genuinely care. And I think that translates into the voices we heard from our students. You know, they were, by the way, both so articulate and clearly also passionate about their futures. So I love the idea of making sure they have a certificate or some kind of confirmation that they can include on their resumes for their work history, and also to recognize those two as well as all of the students who participated. I think that's a great idea, and thank you so much. All right. So we are moving on now to item 5, which is our meeting minutes for February 14th, 2025. I'd like to request a motion and a second.
Madam Chair, I'll make a motion for the minutes as presented today.
All right. I would like to second.
All right. Moved by Board Member Rue, seconded by Board Member Alvarado. Jessica, would you please call the vote?
Board Member Lopez.
Just for meeting minutes.
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado.
Aye.
Board Member Clark.
Aye.
Board Member Rue.
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandora.
Aye.
Chair Nuri.
Aye. And that item passes. We'll now move on to item 6, which is consideration of the consent item. We have one item listed as item 7. I'd like to ask if there are any persons from the public or board member request to remove and discuss the consent item. Jessica, do we have any speaker cards at this time?
No, we do not.
Okay, any board member comments? All right, then if not, I will request a motion and a second for approval of the consent calendar.
Madam Chair, I will make a motion for the consent calendar as presented.
I'll second.
Moved by Board Member Roos, seconded by Board Member Clark. Jessica, please call the roll.
Board Member Lopez.
Aye.
Board Member Alvarado.
Aye.
Board Member Clark.
Aye.
Board Member Rue.
Aye.
Vice Chair Scandora.
Aye.
And Chair Nuri.
Aye. And that item passes. We'll now move to item 8 with an update from the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority overview. The board staff has invited the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority staff to present an overview of their work on the Santa Ana Watershed. This is an information item, and I'd like to, nice to see you again. I'd like to invite Jeff Mosher, General Manager for the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority, to give his presentation.
Thank you, Chair Murray. It's good to see you again. I enjoyed speaking at OCOG yesterday. I hope it went well and was informative.
Very well.
So, Jane, I appreciate the opportunity to present before the board And I appreciate your comments in terms of our collaboration and how well we work together. As you know, I think SAPA provides a forum to be able to work on regional issues, particularly ones that are regulatory in nature, and through our task forces, we work with your staff very closely and with a lot of other stakeholders from around the region, and they've been very successful, so we appreciate that. So going to the next slide, I just want to give you a little bit of background on Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority. Quick overview, so I'll give you a little bit about SAPA, talk about our brine line just to remind us, because we often don't think about it, but it's still there doing great things. Very little on the task forces because you know so much about it, but talk about our OWL program, and that's where I'll talk about this climate adaptation resiliency plan. We have a grant to work on that. And then some regional project, give you examples of what we're doing and some project concept as we look forward. Next. So SAPA is a joint powers authority. We have five member agencies. You may know them well. They're large agencies across the watershed. They cover the entire urban area, if you will, the watershed. They're very good at what they do, and they're a huge resource for SAPA, and that's one reason why we're able to do, I think, really good things is the support of our member agencies. The purpose of SAPA is really to work on regional issues from a water resources and a water quality point of view. The brine line fits into that, and I'll talk about the benefits of the brine line from a water quality and resources point of view. And really our role is to work on regional plans and projects on behalf of our member agencies and other stakeholders in the watershed. You know it's a large watershed. There's a lot of people here. That's a challenge for us too. There's so many stakeholders we try to work with, but I think we've been fairly successful in doing that. Next. So we have three business lines, if you will, the brine line, which is really to manage salt in the watershed, OWL, which I'll talk about in a minute, and then these roundtables, which I'll briefly mention. Next. Again. So the brine line has been around for 40, 50 years. It's 93 miles of pipelines in the upper watershed as well as Orange County. It has a capacity of 30 MGD, so it's fairly large. It removes every day 500,000 pounds of salt that otherwise would end up in our groundwater basins or in our recycled water. So it's very effective at doing that. We take concentrate from desalters, so it provides water supply. Our partner on the brine line is Orange County Sanitation District. They operate the conveyance in Orange County. They do treatment and discharge to the ocean. I like to talk about the natural salt sink is the ocean, but of course you have to do that in an environmentally supportive way. Next slide. So I like to talk about the benefits of the brine line to remind us why this is such an asset, particularly for the upper watershed. So it's meant to take these salty brines and keep them out of POTWs, our wastewater plants, and then provide this service, because otherwise these dischargers, particularly commercial or industrial, could not operate in the Inland Empire unless they could discharge to the brine line. So the water supply benefits are very clear. We have 50 MGD of desalted groundwater capacity. That's the same size as the Carlsbad desal plant in San Diego County, but we don't get as much attention as they do, but it's the same amount of capacity. So it's a large water supply distributed through the upper watershed. There's recycled water benefits because it protects the recycled water from salinity and allows us to recycle more water. In fact, we recycle or put to beneficial use all the recycled water or wastewater effluent in the watershed. And it also provides environmental protection. It's not noted as well, but if there's a plant upset at a POTW, they have the ability to discharge to the brine line as an emergency discharge. So we have that arrangement with OC San. So instead of discharging something that's out of compliance to the environment, right, it goes to the brine line. And our member agencies are very thankful for that because it does happen. Next slide. So I want to talk about the task forces next, please. So this just have one slide just to remind us that, you know, these task forces are forms of collaboration. You guys hear about some of the TMDL task force we have on the Santa Ana River, what we do in Lake Elsinore in terms of the TMDL down there. They're very successful. We have a number of them going on all the time. We have a lot of participation from stakeholders and from the regional board. I could go on, but I'm not. You know that these are a success. We're really proud of this work because it's something that we give back to the region. Next. And again, so I want to talk about the OWOW program. It's been around for a long time, right? Over 15 years. It's been very successful. We have a number of projects that have gotten grant money during that time. It's stakeholder-driven. It operates under DWR's Integrated Regional Water Management Process, where the funding comes from. The focus is on collaboration and creating partnerships and try to think regionally and do regional projects. Many benefits, watershed-wide, multi-benefit projects. Okay, I could go on, a lot of good things. But there's more to the story here. Next slide. So just as a reminder, there's been a lot of money that's come through, but if you look at the Prop 4 in terms of the Integrated Regional Water Management funding, there's only $100 million. And if you allocate that based on how other money in the props have been allocated, we'll get $10 to $11 million. Okay, sure, we can do something with that. But if you look at the other amounts of money that we have gotten through the propositions through IRWM, it's a lot less. So we're trying to think about what else we need to do for the region, because there's a lot of other money in Prop 4, right? Nature-based solutions, stormwater capture. And so our idea is to try to augment IRWM through these other funding sources. That's why we're doing the CARP. I'll talk about that in a second because it represents the priorities of the state. Next slide. So when we think about the state, they're very clear on what their priorities are. You know, climate resiliency comes up. DWR has a watershed resiliency concept. Then you see things that support that, like nature-based solutions, looking at invasive species, habitat restoration. Disadvantaged communities is a huge part of these priorities. So in terms of our planning approach, we want to supplement our current OWOW program under IRWM, looking at climate adaptation resiliency. We want to use our internal general basin planning funding that comes from our member agencies, but also partnership studies. We get grants from USBR on certain projects and looking at other funding sources, including at other state agencies, which typically we haven't done. Next. So I want to go over a couple things that have been successful for us under IRWM. A few years ago, we finished our Disadvantaged Community Involvement Program. This was a $6.3 million grant under IRWM from DWR that involved an ethnographic study that looked at, we used an anthropologist from University of California, Irvine, to develop an approach where we embedded individuals in communities and talked to them about their perspectives on water and their issues. So this ethnographic support process was very valuable. We learned a lot from that. We're trying to incorporate that in what we do now. So there were over 50 workshops. Half of them were in Spanish. Very successful. So if you go to the next slide, one of the things that came out of that is we identified water supply needs for these small disadvantaged communities. And DWR provided us with a $5 million grant under the 2021 Urban and Multi-Benefit Drought Relief Grant Program when there was a surplus of money. You remember those days? So we got $5 million. We had projects set up. So it was very quick to award those that funding to those projects. So it built on our disadvantaged community involvement program. What was nice about this funding, there was no local cost share, so it could pay for 100% of these projects for these disadvantaged communities. So the next slide is a list of these five projects. They're all water supply, so it's rehabbing old wells. It's installing additional infrastructure to provide higher quality water. One of the facilities had an arsenic issue that was resolved through this. So very effective, and I think this demonstrates the IRWM program works. We would like for DWR to continue to use it. So that's one of the things that we talked to them about. Next slide. So the other message I want to provide is our projects are going to start looking different. They're not, may not be just a water supply project. So this grant was actually, we partnered with City of Riverside. It was with the Strategic Growth Council, and we were one part of it. We did water use efficiency, but there was urban greening, there were solar installations, transit options. But this was one project, and grants are coming out of the state that look like this. So we think we can play a role, partner with cities and other organizations. What was nice about this water conservation program, it was 100% for disadvantaged communities where we paid for 100% of the installation, the replacement of their lawns. There was no $3 per square foot or anything like that. It was 100% paid for. These type of communities are only, I think, going to participate in a program that's like this. Next slide. So DWR has this watershed resilience concept, and we like it. We're a watershed. There's a lot of advantages to it. It's still being formulated under DWR. If you look at the $100 million that's coming from Prop 4, we probably won't see that money for a couple years. They're going to spend some time thinking through this. So we don't want to wait for them. We want to start working on this type of concept. So once they have money, we'll be positioned for grants once they come out. Next slide. So this leads into this Climate Adaptation Resiliency Plan that we received a grant from the Governor's Office of Land Use and Climate Innovation, not DWR, right? It's for different types. It's for counties. We're a water district, one of the few water districts that got a grant. And the whole idea is to help build climate resilience within the watershed. Next slide. So we spent a lot of time talking to them, finding out what they wanted. So when we submitted a proposal, we were hoping that it was awarded. It was. They have certain components in there. There's a strong community-based component. So we're reaching out to both communities and tribal nations through this. We're working with our member agencies. If you go to the next slide. The benefits of the CARP, these come from us as well as the state agency. We want to advance watershed resiliency. We want to define watershed-wide climate risk and what those vulnerabilities are. We want to develop adaptation strategies, enhance multi-jurisdictional collaboration, and this will hopefully support us as a region going after funding in the future, whether it's at through the state or through other federal agencies. Next slide. So in terms of the organization, SAPA is the lead agency, but we're co-applicants are SABOBA for tribal engagement and Inland Southern California Climate Collaborative and UC Riverside for the community engagement. And so there's a strong component here to get other perspectives, including the public agencies. Again, we're going to focus on risk vulnerabilities and adaptation projects. This will take about a year and a half. And then on the next slide, I guess give a concept. So we're going to do this through various engagement, you know, workshops on the risk and vulnerabilities first, then talking to those same communities on adaptation strategies and having them involved. So the next slide, I believe, is going to be a concept of how we're thinking about it. Okay. So, you know, the process we think is fairly straightforward. Talk to these various communities about what they think their climate risks are. You know, ask them specifically if it's flooding, if it's drought, extreme heat, and then what they think the vulnerabilities to those are. And then we can formulate adaptation strategies and projects to address them. So this is from statewide guidance, but it is a lot of work. It's a big watershed where we're going to operate by our member agency service areas. So there's a lot of work to do to get this information. And then at the end of the day, we would put this up in a online format that people could use, go for grants, things like that. It's really a benefit for the entire watershed. Next slide. Okay, so I always have to talk about cloud seeding. You may have heard about it. I just want you guys to be aware that we're doing this project. So we were asked by our commission to look at this. It's a pilot study. We have a grant, an IRWN grant under Prop 1 to do this. Our region, in terms of our mountains, are set up to be able to do cloud seeding, but we need to see if it works for us. If you go to the next slide, I want to give you an idea of where we're doing this. We have four target areas in high elevations. The goal is to put more snow in these high elevations that would augment our local supply. It does involve the use of silver iodide. That is the particulate that the ice forms around. That does get a lot of attention from the public in terms of, you know, we're putting this, it's inert, it's not toxic, it's not on any EPA priority list. CARB is not interested in silver iodide because it's inert. It's basically a dust particle. So we do get a lot of attention because people, and all ours are ground-based, but people think that cloud seeding results in contrails, condensation trails. So we get a lot of comments. We got a lot of input. And so it's mixed in terms of whether or not people think we ought to be doing it. And that's part of the decision that our commission is going to have to take into consideration from a policy point of view, is how the public thinks about cloud seeding. So one of the things we're doing as part of this pilot is to validate it, see if it works. It's difficult to do. You can't do it directly. You have to do it indirectly. So we're working with an independent research institute, Desert Research Institute, to do this. We have 1 year of data. We have 12 storms from that year. It was 2 years ago. It was, as you remember, it was very wet. We did not cloud seed this past year because of all the burn scars. The flood control districts told us that they would be more comfortable if we skipped a year and didn't contribute to burn scars. And of course, we're going to listen to that. And it's a study. We don't have to do this every year. So the next slide is some preliminary, photographs of the units. They're not involved. They're at different places around the watershed, mainly on public agency property. So that part was fairly straightforward. And it's low cost. You can kind of see there's not a lot of equipment. Next slide. So a visual of how this works. So we had a feasibility study modeling, and this gives you an idea that when you release the silver iodide from these ground-based units, they're brought up the side of the mountains into clouds where ice starts forming on the particles. They get heavy, and they fall as snow. It has been shown to work in a bench scale as well as in the environment, but we need to verify this because it's money that if we invest in, we want to benefit from. Next slide. Okay, so here's some preliminary results. So the question is, does it work, right? So we have to do this indirect targeting control. So we have a control area where there's no cloud seeding and a target area where the seeding occurs. And we look at individual snow gauges in those target areas and compare it to the control. So the star is the representation of the 12 storms that occurred during this year that we cloud seeded. And so for these two gauges, these are gauges up in the mountains for the northeast target area, we did see an increase. But you see there's variability around the line. So the variability is reason why we have to do this for 4 years. We need more data than 1 year, but it's promising that shows that it's positive at least for this target area. If you go to the next slide. So what does this mean for the program? So two of the target areas showed a positive increase. Two of the target areas showed no increase. So we converted the amount of snow increase in percent based on the number of generators and its footprint to an acre foot. So we estimated it was about additional 20,000 acre feet of water in terms of stream flow. If you hit the next one more time. The reason why this is attractive, it was about $400,000 to do this. That equates to about $20 per acre foot. That's why we have to think so hard. If this is validated, it's so cost effective, there would be a lot of interest, I think, in continuing it. But we need to do three more years. We're skipping a year. We'll still do three more years. We'll have more information, and at that point, we'll bring it back to our commission. Next slide. So the other thing I want to talk to you about is PFAS. So that is of interest, obviously, to everybody. It gets into biosolids. It's in effluent. It's in drinking water. It gets in groundwater supplies. And so our member agencies got together and decided that we would try to do a watershed analysis where we would develop a model. The point of having this graphic up here is to show you that we're looking at a lot of the inputs and where the water ends up. We have a model, a surface water model, that runs through this. We use it for other purposes, so we repurpose it for PFAS. And we want to see where the PFAS moves through the watershed. So if you go to the next slide, these are all the station, the monitoring stations, USGS gauges, so we can get information on where PFAS is in the watershed for this model, and then we can, through this model, estimate through the subsurface watersheds how much PFAS flows in, how much PFAS flows out, how much ends in the groundwater basin. One more slide. I don't have any numbers for you at this point. We're still working on this. Okay, one more, please. And so where we would end up with is these are all the sub-basins in the watershed. Through the modeling, we can show how much of the load ends up on these groundwater basins, and then groundwater basin managers could use that. But this gives an indication of where PFAS is moving, and so the next phase of this is we would look at where we could do mitigation on PFAS to reduce where it ends up. So it's very involved, about two-thirds of the way through this. At some point, we'll be able to talk about it more, but we're really trying to figure out how PFAS is moving and coming up with that assessment. Next slide. So the last thing, I'll go through this quickly. We're involved in invasive species management. Arundo has been one we've worked on. It sucks up water in the tributaries and the Santa Ana River. It really doesn't have any benefits. Next slide. So we have money from a mitigation bank that we use to remove Arundo. We did do some AI deep learning tool where we looked at photographs of the entire watershed and assessed where Arundo is. It looks small, right? But it's a big watershed. There's Arundo throughout. We want to form a regional partnership to use our seed funding to start eradicating or removing as much as we can of Arundo in the river. Next slide. We do have a current project with Inland Empire Resource Conservation District. You probably know them. They're really good at what they do. They did a survey of Arundo in the upper watershed. We're thinking we'd start up at the watershed and move down. And that's going really well, so we'll probably augment these types of projects moving forward. Next. So the last thing I want to talk to you about is potential regional concepts. We get asked a lot to look at things. So the approach here is to review with our member agencies because we do need their support for the activities that we work on. But some of the regional efforts involve invasive species, as I mentioned, but a regional collaboration, a stream gauge program where we would have regional stream gauge program. We would assess flows that would help us with water supply planning. We've done aerial imagery for the entire watershed. It may be more advantageous to go to satellite options. It can be done quicker and cheaper. Sediment management is becoming an issue behind Prado, other areas. So we have sediment where we don't need it, and then there's other places in the watershed where we want sand, particularly on the beaches. And so try to figure out how to make that work. It does cost a lot of money to move sand. It's heavy. We want to look at nature-based solutions. Maybe there's regional projects. We want to do a watershed dashboard. We have a set of indicators, but put it online. It would tell us more about the health of the watershed. And forest management, we work with a couple of our member agencies on that now, but I think there's more we can do. So I think that was my last slide, and I'll be happy to answer any questions if you had any.
Thank you so much. That's a lot of good information and some incredible work that's happening. So exciting.
I appreciate that.
To share that with the region. Board members, Board Member Lopez.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for the presentation. It certainly is a lot of work that has been taken on by SAPA, but I just want to say that from the time that I served on the board many years ago, several years back, I know that SAPA has always been recognized by state officials, local officials, regional officials as a leader in water quality. SAPA has been a tremendous asset to the region and all the work that you do on behalf of the citizens of this area. We appreciate it very much. Residents, I say. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Because I think one of the advantages is we can work regionally, where other agencies can only work within their service areas. Yeah. We try to take advantage of that as much as we can.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. Board Member Alvarado.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to say, thank you again, ECHO, and I'm looking forward to the study and the assessment of PFAS. I think that was a part of everything that just woke in my ears, and I know that we talked about it, and there's other regions that talk about it and other water boards that talk about it, but this is very important, and the way you describe it is exactly what we needed. We need to trace it. We need to know where it ends up, and the amount. And I know you don't have numbers, but this is, I'm looking forward for that assessment. Thank you so much for all the work.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Board Member Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for a great report. Congratulations on all the grant funding that you've received to do these important studies. I had a question. It was toward the beginning of your presentation. You mentioned some community engagement meetings or forums that you're going to have. Can you just go in a little bit more detail about where those are being held and how the public will find out about them?
Yeah. So the first project we did, that was a $6.3 million disadvantaged community involvement program. That completed right when I showed up at SOPA 4 years ago. But the concept was that we use this ethnographic approach where they call it it's inreach, not outreach, right? Mm. And the idea is go to their communities and talk to them about these issues. And so what was done is through the UCI anthropologist and other academics, they brought on people that knew the community and were involved in their organizations. Mm-hmm. And so they went to where they met in their facilities. And SOPA staff didn't go. So we left it up to the people who were the inreach experts and talking to them. What we got was all the output from those. And then there was a follow-up part of the design was to go back and then tell them what else we heard. So what we're trying to do now is learn from that and incorporate that to other planning that we do. So when we're looking at the Climate Adaptation Resiliency Plan, we're going to try to mimic some of that. And so we have eight community-based organizations that we're going to be working with. We're going to bring on others. Mm-hmm. That's why we're working with UCR, an academic center mm-hmm. that specializes in this, and try to, again, go back into their communities at their meetings with their members and stakeholders and ask them about these questions and make it very simple, right? And through that dialogue, get that input. We can talk to water agencies. That's easy. Mm-hmm. So we'll do that, but we're going to get this other set of information from these community groups a couple times, risk, vulnerabilities, and then adaptation strategies, and then tell them what we did, and then incorporate that into what the member agencies tell us.
That's excellent. I mean, so you guys are really creating a safe space not only to educate them about what you're doing, but to hear from them about what they know and what maybe they'd like to know.
We think the CBOs are going to be able to do that for us. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Inreach, not outreach. Okay, I might start that. Thank you. That's good.
Thank you. That was going to be one of my questions, so I appreciate it. Board Member Rue.
Thank you for a very thorough overview of what SOPA is doing. I go back to the days with the origination of the Brine Line, people such as Bill Hill and John Anderson, who way back when envisioned this, and we're where we are today because of a lot of leaders 30, 40 years ago who said this is going to be important in the future. We may not be there to see the final product, but we're going to do this. And the outreach you're doing in the community is absolutely wonderful. We need this. More people need to understand what is going on. They need to understand about the watershed. You're right about the Arundo. Not only does it take up a lot of water, it's a very invasive plant. It just keeps growing and growing. And we need, you're doing the right thing by culling it out of there because we don't need it. We need other things. So thank you.
Board Member Rue, also thank you for being on the OWL Steering Committee. And Skandura, thank you for being the alternate. We appreciate your help on that.
Thank you. Vice Chair Skandura.
Sure. And thank you, Jeff, for the outstanding presentation. And it's definitely a privilege for me, a pleasure to serve on the OWL Steering Committee. I had to participate by video conference last time, but hopefully I can make it in person. Let's see, a couple questions regarding the brine line that Board Member Rue just talked about.
Sure.
Are there plans to expand it or extend it at this point?
We just finished a master plan. It was actually the first master plan that's been done on the brine line since it was built. And we did that because these type of questions came up. So we're about halfway through the capacity. So it's 30 MGD capacity. We have 15 MGD of flows going through it now. So there's plenty of capacity, which is good. Mm-hmm. But we want to plan for that, where desalters are going to be, other industrial. And we get calls routinely from commercial, industrial companies about, and they're small flows, but it's important that they be able to send into the brine line. We're looking at some other things in terms of the brine line. We were approached by a green hydrogen program in the state called ARCHES. I don't know if you've heard of it, but they have a lot of money coming from DOE, and they need water to be able to produce green hydrogen. And so they're not going to get potable water, so they have to look at non-traditional water. And so we're included in their feasibility study, and if it's possible to produce green hydrogen from our brine flows, that would be a significant, that would be a game changer. So that's still very early, but trying to think of how we've turned wastewater into a resource, right? We want to think about turning brine flows into a resource, and there's things that we can do there. And that's why we did this master plan. And the master plan also covers PFAS, because we do have PFAS in the brine line flows. Right. And so that's a concern for us as well.
Well, that's very interesting, because at this point right now, all the brine that's collected actually goes down to Orange County Sanitation District's plant, and then ultimately out to the ocean. So that's a very fascinating one. The other question I had was, you mentioned about mitigation banks, and I'm sure you've been following the agenda, but a lot of our consent calendar items involve development projects where waters of the state are altered or eliminated, and so as compensation, we have them restore along mitigation banks. And today, for instance, our consent calendar item was mitigation along the Sokol Canyon, and in the past we've done it on the Santa Ana River Bank. And is SOPA involved in those mitigation projects?
So we are not involved in those specific projects. However, we've been approached about doing a mitigation bank or trading type concept that it's in the very preliminary stages that would benefit those that need to mitigate as part of projects. So there's been a number of conversations with us in the last year about that. I can't say anything about that at this point, but it's something that's actively being thought through.
Okay. And then the last request is to make sure that all the board members here are on the mailing list for SOP, especially for meetings and roundtables. And then, if there's events like ribbon-cutting events, so to speak, it certainly represents an opportunity for us to get out into the region and see the kinds of projects that are going on, as well as interact with the stakeholders. So that, and then if you have any, like, newsletters that you develop.
Sure.
I'm on the mailing list for some of the water district or for some of the member agencies now. So if we can get those, that would be great.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And on the PFAS front, there's a lot of innovation happening there, too, much like you're talking about with the brine opportunities with the ARCHES program for other hydrogen and other clean energies. One, I'm fascinated about that and would love to learn more, because that program alone is doing some great work. So it's nice to know that can be, and the brine flow can be helpful there. But with the PFAS aspect as well, there's a lot of emerging technology to remove PFAS relatively cost effectively. I'm just wondering, you know, what discussions or, you know, opportunities there might be to engage some of those industries that are on that front line.
Right. So I think our PFAS study is going to look at mitigation options, which will look at potential treatment. And the idea is you want to put it's going to be a lot of money. It's going to be billions of dollars, right, for the entire watershed. So where is it? Could you do a regional project? Where would you get the biggest bang for your buck in terms of putting treatment? Mm-hmm. We're not focusing on what that treatment is yet, but what I envision is that once we have an idea of where we think we would want to invest, our member agencies would probably be willing to look at pilot projects, maybe try to get grants for things like that, looking at these innovative technologies. So I don't know if you're talking about drinking water or wastewater. So drinking water.
Well, and both fronts, honestly. I was at a Sustain SoCal program about 6 months ago, and a number of these industries, and there were some that are international and mm-hmm. some that are national that are emerging. I'm even wondering if there's an a P3 option where you might be able to get the private sector who wants to build the credibility of their product to invest in doing a pilot study.
I think that's right. And I think on biosolids, like a P3 would you think of composting, a similar concept. Mm-hmm. Drinking water, we have technologies. There could be innovative ones that could be cheaper. That'd be great. Yeah. The wastewater side is much more of the Wild West.
Right.
We think we have technologies, but they haven't been proven so much.
Correct.
That's where I think a lot of the work is, and I think that would be a lot of the interest of the regional board. That's the water that flows into the watershed.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay. And try to clean it before it ends up in our oceans and our food supply and other things.
We have a lot to do there.
Yep. Thank you. Well, wonderful. This was very helpful. And I would absolutely love to be on your mailing list, too. So thank
okay.
you.
Thank you so much.
Great idea, Vice Chair. Thank you.
Good seeing you.
All right. Well, that was fascinating. I even have more questions, but we got to move on. So thank you for your time, and I'll follow up. Now I would like to go to item 9 and invite Steve Weisberg, Executive Director of the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project Overview, that's a mouthful, to give his presentation.
Thank you very much. Jeff, what a great presentation, and what an incredibly tough act to follow. But I'm hoping to walk out of here with you all going, wow, we are really lucky to have two such great joint powers agencies operating on regional scales in our vicinity. So, first slide, exactly like Jeff said, we are a joint powers agency. Our mission is to provide unbiased scientific foundation for water quality management in Southern California. We don't do policy. We don't do regulation. We don't do implementation. But we judge our success on whether the science we are doing is, in fact, informing all of those kinds of things. And hopefully the science that we are doing is reaching you. I think we are a unique organization at that level, but we are also unique in the sense of who makes us up. If you can go to the next slide, please. There are 14 members of SCWRP, four of which are the largest POTWs in Southern California, actually the four of the top 10 in the world. Four of the stormwater management agencies, basically the county public works departments, and six regulatory or management oversight groups. So all of them are public agencies, but there's a combination of regulators and regulated. And of course, you will see that the Santa Ana Regional Board is one of those member agencies. Next slide, please. The real key to SCWRP is not just the science that we do, but the forum that we provide for interaction among those 14 agencies. I have a board that meets once a quarter that is made up of the heads of those 14 agencies. Jane Joy is one of my 14 bosses. The real power of SCWRP is being able to bring that science to 14 people who look at it from different perspectives and see whether or not they can get consensus on how they're going to use that information. And in some cases, they arrive at that quickly. For instance, one of the things that we're doing in California that is being done, leading the world in doing it, is the use of beach water quality monitoring using genetic methods instead of culture-based methods. Culture-based methods, you take a sample, you filter it, you take the filter, you put it onto an auger, you let it grow for 48 hours, and then you say, you shouldn't have been swimming here 3 days ago. We now have genetic methods that allow you to get an answer in 2 hours. And so if you're trying to figure out how quickly to close a beach or where to close a beach, you know, you get a spill and you want to be able to track it, those are tools that are available. Those kinds of things went through very quickly because you have the people who are doing it, say the sanitation agencies, and the people who are overseeing them, like you all, at the table at the same time to go, is this tool developed enough? The commission is supported by a technical advisor group, basically the lead scientist for each of the member agencies. For what it's worth, your representative is actually the chair now of CTAG. And really the key, though, is this powerful interface between science and management. So next slide, please. What I've been asked to do today is, first off, give you a short overview on who SCWRP is, but then to pick three projects that we're working on and give you a kind of five-minute vignette on each. I developed that list of projects with Jane. If any of you want to hear more than 5 minutes, glad to come back or send you more information. And at the end of the day, I'll tell you some of the other things we're working on if you have any questions about that. I'd be glad to extemporaneously hit upon it. So next slide, please. The thing that I was asked to start with is the Southern California Bite Regional Monitoring Program. We have in Southern California the best integrated regional monitoring program for ocean water quality anywhere in the world. I was one of the people who helped set up the Chesapeake Bay Monitoring Program. It's what I did before I came here. We've got it better. We have an incredible amount of partnership to get it done. How it evolved is in the late 1980s, the National Academy of Sciences did a review of monitoring programs all around the world and said, how effective are they? How are they being used? And they did a case study in Southern California. And they reached the conclusion that, first off, 70% of the monitoring that was done by regulated parties as part of NPDES permit requirements. And that if you took a look at all the monitoring, you couldn't answer the most basic question. What's the condition of the ocean? And it's mostly because most of the monitoring was being done as part of regulatory programs right around the outfall. And so we knew a lot about 3% of the area and not much about 97% of the area. And moreover, even within the 3%, not everybody was measuring the same things, and not necessarily measuring them in the same ways. Right? And even when they were, they didn't have a common data sharing system or a common interpretation framework. And this presentation was made by my predecessor at SQRP to the SQRP Commission. They said, so what should we do about it? And he made the suggestion that once every 5 years, we should take the monitoring programs that are done, and instead of having them focus just around the outfall, put a same amount of effort into a regional monitoring program. And SQRP would be the group that essentially developed the standardized methods by which people use, did the quality assurance to make sure they were doing it right, picked sample stages that were distributed around, and then put together an integrated report that all of the participants participated in the development of. Next slide. We started in 1994 with a single element. Looking at sediment quality, we now have 8 elements in the BITE program. So we have beach water quality, we do. We have a harmful algal bloom program. We have a shellfish program now. Next slide, please. So I'm going to take you through a little bit what one of those elements looks like. And the question for this one is sediment quality. What's the extent and magnitude of sediment quality? And it's also trends. We had 90 agencies, or I shouldn't say organizations. Some of them were academic institutions, but 90 organizations participate in this effort. Next slide, please. This gives you kind of a summary. We had, again, we do this once every 5 years. We have 340 sites that involve 9 different vessels on the water to collect it. We had 15 different labs that would analyze the samples when they came back because, again, what we're asking people to do is participate, not just give us money to do it, but actually participate. And one of the real values of that is that we're getting all the labs to do things the same. You can see that we have what's called a stratified random sampling design. If you want to be able to say, what does the whole look like? It's sort of like if you want to know who's going to win the next election, you don't go down to, you know, your local bar where all your friends hang out and ask, because you're only going to get the answers from those people. You have to distribute randomly. Now, we end up doing what we call a stratified random design, where we go to various habitats. I want to know, how does an estuary compare to the offshore ocean? And then we randomize the samples within that, so it allows us to get a representative sample. Next slide, please. And this is the kind of thing that we get out of it. This happens to be a result for sediment toxicity. When we do the sediment sampling, we also measure all the chemicals. We also measure the benthic infauna, the worms that live in the mud, to see whether it's a healthy community. We also look at contamination of fish tissue that live there. But this is the toxicity outcome, and that happens to be for 2023. And you can see, actually, it's not a bad answer. The amount of areas that we have high toxicity are very limited, and we know where they are. So it allows you to focus in. And you can see, obviously, not everything is equal. You can see the continental shelf is not bad. The bays are not bad. As you get into the estuaries, you get a little bit less circulation. Not as good. Go next slide, please. We've been doing this program for now over 30 years, so we're able to produce this kind of graphic. Are things getting better or worse?
And you can see, actually, things are, in general, getting better. So, again, you have not a lot of change, but where you do have change, the blue, it's getting better. Next slide. Okay, now, this is where the BITE program started, to get these kinds of answers. But where it has really evolved in a good way is three other things that you get. First off, quality assurance. When we're pulling together 90 organizations participating, or 15 laboratories processing, we've got to make sure they're all doing it the same. Right? So we run samples that we know what the answer is, give them out to everybody else, and see how close they come. When we did this the first time in 1994, the laboratories were 400-fold apart on a typical sample. Right? And so we did a lot of work to get them all to the same endpoint. Now, in this program, they're within 30% of each other. And that transcends from the BITE program. My commissioner has told me this is the most valuable part of the BITE program, because what we do in this BITE regional program is maybe 5% of the samples that we process. I now know that the sample processing I'm doing on the other 95% is up to a level of quality. The other thing it allows us to do is address new issues and new methods. So next slide, please. So regional monitoring, we measure new chemicals each time. It's not a set list. Right? And where this is really powerful is it's hard for you all, not hard, but maybe inadvisable for you all, to try and put a long list of chemicals into every individual permit. It takes a while for those labs to get up to it. And, of course, the people who are regulated know that once something gets into a permit, it's very hard to get out of a permit. A regional monitoring program allows you to get the big picture to determine whether or not it is important enough that you want to get down to that more local level. And you can see the kind of things that we measured. The reason you see fipronil taken off is because we did it for a few years. We found the numbers were so low within Southern California, we didn't even need to continue doing it. And when I say we, this was the group of like 100 organizations participating, going, we all agree that this isn't important. Go to the next slide. The other thing that we do is this provides us a new mechanism for testing out new technologies. So microplastics, I'll talk about that next. We are using microplastic methods in the BITE program. It's the test, again, same thing. It's the precursor to what you might or might choose not to do in your programs at the local facility. We can answer these at the big level. Do they help? Are they useful? And so you can see up there, I put droplet digital PCR, that is the beach water quality method. But eDNA, if I had extra time, I'd talk to you about extracellular DNA. Tell you what, I'll give you a 10-second vision of that. If you want to know whether you've got an endangered species or an invasive species in your watershed, you can send divers down there, you can do all kinds of things, or you can just take a bottle of water, because organisms shed DNA. And we can take a bottle of water and tell you what's upstream, and we can tell you whether an invasive species is there. It's one of the leaders in the world in developing that kind of technology. And we're test driving it, trying to get it out of our laboratory into all the other participating laboratories using the BITE program as the vehicle. Next slide. Next topic I was asked to talk about is microplastics. So California in 2018 passed two pieces of legislation. The first is 1422 requires that the drinking water community develop a microplastics method for institution. An implementation of that method in, I think, 2022 it was required. There's also SB 1263, which is more ocean-oriented. It required the Ocean Protection Council to develop a microplastics management strategy. You have to understand where microplastics is. It's one of these curves in terms of what we know and what we're learning. So, next slide. There's a lot of science that we need to do if we're going to achieve those kind of things. The things you need to do is you need to develop standard methods. I will tell you that in 2018, there were no standard methods. There wasn't even a standard approach on how you do it. There's a whole classes of methods. We, as scientists, had not agreed upon the classes of methods, much less which method, much less which standard operating procedure. You need to have a risk assessment framework. How are you going to interpret the data? And then you need to do some things to kind of find out what's actually in the environment. How do you develop a strategic plan if you don't have any data? Next slide. So SQRP took a leadership role in making sure that we were meeting those needs. For methods, we held a workshop, pulled together all the experts, and we said, which are the best methods that are ready to go soon? We identified five. And then we did an evaluation study where we created blind samples, sent them out to people doing these methods, and saw how close they could come. And we narrowed down to two methods that are the ones that work best. And we write standard operating procedures for them. And better yet, we trained ELAP, the state's Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program, on how to validate that a lab is in fact doing that SOP correctly. California is the only place in the world that has standard operating procedures and laboratory accreditations for microplastics. Only one anywhere in the world. Next slide. Field methods. We're doing the same thing for field methods. You think, oh, the laboratory is the big deal. Actually, if you're going to go into the water in the ocean environment, we have more variability associated with the collection method. First off, you've got a problem with everybody. Actually, not today. I usually wear plastic shirts. I got cotton one on today. But how you make sure that you're not contaminating the sample is a big deal. But when you go to the sample, you have some people doing it by dragging a net. You have some people taking a bottle. You have some people doing pumps. They give radically different answers, in part because the nets are porous. But it's also because where do you put the pump? You know, do you put it right at the surface? Do you put it further down? Which day do you take the sample? Because some plastics are dense, some plastics are light, and if you take it on a really calm day and you take it from 5 feet down, you're not going to have much because they are essentially separated. You get a really turbulent day, everything mixes. So you can get very different answers. We're trying to develop standard operating procedures for how you do that. In fact, we have done that now for water column samples. We've done that for ocean water column samples. We've done that for how do you do it in sediment. We've done it for how do you do it in biota. The hardest one for us, the one we're working on, and we're working on it in your backyard, basically, is how do you do it for runoff? Because you get a lot of turbulent flooding, it's very hard to make the sample. It's also hard to figure out where in the water column you want to grab the sample, how much integration you need to do. So those are the kind of things that we're working on, hopefully to get you to the point that you know how to move forward. I'm starting to run a little long, so I'm going to skip a slide or two here. Next slide. Just to let you know, we're doing a lot of work on sources and sinks. You want to know, where's it coming from? So we have programs right now to look at what comes out of wastewater treatment plants, actually what comes into wastewater treatment plants. It turns out they remove like 99%, and then what comes out of wastewater treatment plants. Same thing with stormwater, you know, what's coming out. And then we're doing some things in our bite regional program to kind of tell you how much is reaching the biota, how much is reaching the sediment. Next slide. And then how much is too much, I'm just going to leave it as that's the one that's still early in the game. In part because we didn't have standard measurement methods, the people who were doing the toxicity studies weren't doing them all the same. They weren't even measuring the amount of plastics the same. So we're starting as scientists now to standardize that kind of stuff. We're starting to build a database that will allow us to do it. Next slide. Okay, I'm going to finish up by my third vignette, which is best management practices. This is a big deal because of the amount of money that's being spent, probably the amount of money in some cases you're requiring people to spend on how do we clean up stormwater. In Los Angeles, $300 million a year. And we don't know how well those things work. We don't know what chemicals they work best on. We don't know what's the maintenance requirement. You put it in once, you put it in a bioswale, and you forget it for the rest of your life, or do you have to essentially, let's say you've got some great char in there that's grabbing all the chemicals. Well, it's doing such a great job of curing chemicals, at some point it becomes a problem itself. You know, when are you going to start pulling that stuff out and replacing it, the maintenance schedule? And so we have developed a whole BMP monitoring network to start to get those questions. I'm going to narrow in on one topic. Go to the next slide, please, which is street sweeping. Almost everybody has a street sweeping requirement, and nobody knows, does it really work? And if it does work, all right, does street sweeper A versus street sweeper B work better? Should you be doing this once a week, once a month, once a year, just in a seed in the storm? And we've got a study that's going on to answer exactly those questions. Next slide. One of the cool things that we have to do, the way we're doing these studies, is we go to places like parking lots, and we segment into this area gets no street sweeping, this area gets once a week, this area gets once a month, et cetera. And then we come in with this thing we've developed here, which is an artificial rainfall generator. And essentially, it's just a big study of how much do these different areas differ. Go to the next slide. I want to show you, you have to go through those. There you go. One of the things you think, oh, this is simple, just get out there with a garden hose and, you know. No, if you hit it with too much pressure, you'll wash everything off. right? But that doesn't mimic rainfall. You get hit with too much mist, nothing runs off. All right? So how do you mimic a storm? That device we built is intended so it allows us to mimic different types of storms. And a large part of our study is even, you see the little graph there, of can I get even distribution and distribution with the right physics to match a regular rainstorm to do the kinds of studies. So anyway, those are the kind of things that we develop. Next slide. I'll let you know, we actually have the initial outcomes. And for what it's worth, street sweeping does work. And in fact, you all probably have to give essentially credits to people for essentially what they've accomplished by doing street sweeping. We've got numbers for you. We've got the beginnings of numbers for you. We'll have a lot more as we do more detail. Again, how often do you need to do it kind of thing. Last slide. And I'll just leave you with, I've given you three vignettes. We got lots more I'd be excited to talk to you about. Up there are the range of things that we are working on. I'm glad to answer questions about what we're doing in general or go on to any of those topics you find interesting.
Thank you. And I think you filled the shoes in the prior speaker very well. So that was very informative, lots of good detail. So I would just like to first open up to my colleagues, Board Member Lopez.
Well, thank you for that presentation. I will push the golden buzzard for the both speakers, okay? Yeah. You know, quite very informative, and I really appreciate it. My question was on street sweeping. I was involved with the street sweeping many years ago, and there was a question there: how much street sweeping the city was required to do, and all that. So I'm just kind of, what is it that street sweeping does or doesn't do anymore? I'm not involved in it anymore. I have no interest in it anymore. But for many years, you know, I was associated with a contractor that we did a lot of sweeping throughout cities, throughout Southern California. But I was just curious, you know, what, you know, without, you know, getting into detail, you said that they're going to continue studying something.
So there were, are you able to put the slide back up? There were actually a slide I had up there that had numbers of what the reductions are. Right now, I'll tell you 30% reduction. Depends on the chemical, obviously. Depends on how you run the street sweeper, but it's not trivial.
Thank you. Any other members of the board? I do. Vice Chair Scandura.
Well, thank you very much for the fine presentation. I do have some questions and then a request at the end. One of your early slides mentioned that you're finding some high toxicity in the estuaries, at least some of it. Which estuaries are we still finding these kind of toxicity issues?
I'll have to actually get that to you. I didn't come with a list of what specific locations have that, but we have that.
Okay.
Glad to follow up with you.
And then one of your slides, you stumped me. What on earth is a neonicotinoid pesticide?
It's just the it's the next generation of pesticides.
Mm. What are the targets for these kind of pesticides?
It's basically the same kind of things that you're using on crops and others to get rid of pests.
I see. And then I also saw there was the fipronil pesticides. I don't know what those are, but since we're not finding them, I'm not going to ask about it.
It's fipronil, and yes, again, there are many times we find that things are issues, and one of the values, I think, of SQRP, again, because it's got representation from both regulators and regulated parties, it gets to the point of being able to go, okay, we've agreed that this is not a problem. When you have just a discharger going, yeah, I don't think it's a problem. Being able to work together really, I think, helps you move forward. Sure. And now it's an example of one we identified. Less of a problem.
Okay. And then this is something that you didn't cover in your slides, but I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago we voted on extending the time schedule order for coliforms and shellfish. And one of the things that came up was that the method they're relying on goes back to, God forbid, 1924. And how are we doing as far as developing a new, more up-to-date method on that?
Okay, so I purposely did not pick that one because I was trying to pick on things that were more generic, not too, you know, regional. Yeah. But I'm glad to expand on that. So The issue that he is bringing up is that in the Newport Bay, you have two bacterial, essentially, thresholds. You have the recreational water threshold, and you have the shellfish threshold. And the shellfish threshold is very low. It's basically measuring fecal coliforms in water. And what we have found in the work that we have done is that if you go to the best reference sites in the state, about half of them fail that standard, all right, in the best watersheds, all right? And so as you all got, Newport Bay is failing that standard, and as you started to think about what you're going to do with it, the question that was asked uniformly by you all, by the NGOs, by the regulated parties, the stormwater folks, was, do we really believe that standard? And essentially what you're doing is you're saying, if I have 14 colony-forming units of fecal coliform in the water column, then I'm going to have unhealthy shellfish. So what we did is we did a study. We went into the watershed, and we took all of the samples you would normally do in the water column, and we also took samples of viruses and other things in the shellfish, and we looked to see, are they correlated? And the answer was, not only are they not correlated, they're slightly negatively correlated. And let me tell you why. Because during the study, we actually had one small spill that occurred. Right? And because the water column dissipates quickly, and you're only taking once a week sample in the water column, we didn't actually find it. But the shellfish did pick up the spill. All right. So in a sense, you just, again, I could show you graphics of that, but in a sense, it was not a good predictor. And so that puts you all in a difficult circumstance of what do you do now? You know, if that's a bad standard, what is the good standard? We have a study that I think we're planning to do next summer to continue that kind of work. Where we're thinking about going. This is one of the things that's been really advantageous is that we have developed these genetic methods, all right? And so I'm giving you a very long answer, but this I think is very relevant to things you're going to have to deal with soon. What we really want to know is, are there viruses in the shellfish? Historically, measuring viruses is very difficult. They're what we call obligate anaerobes. You can't have them in an open air system. They're also very difficult to work with. Most people don't want to have the biological safety level 3, which is what you'd be requiring to do those kind of things. But we have developed genetic methods for doing beach water quality. And when you switch from bacteria to viruses, it's almost the same method. You're just swapping out what we call primer probe sets, basically the target. And so now I can measure viruses in the shellfish at relatively low cost. And so I think where you all are headed, where we are headed to hopefully help you, you can decide where you're headed, but what we're hoping to develop for you are the tools that allow you to measure the shellfish pathogens themselves and go, do we really have a pathogen problem? It's a little bit more expensive than doing it in the water column, but on the other hand, you're not doing an extrapolation. You're actually measuring the thing you care about. We're developing the tools that would allow you to do that.
So that is great to hear. So we're going to be looking at more than just coliforms. We're also going to be looking at viruses then. And that's great to hear. I actually did my graduate work on viruses in the environment at North Carolina. My professor developed a lot of those methods, so that's great.
I'm guessing, we are working with people from the University of North Carolina on that.
Yeah, great. Go Tar Heels. and then last of all, a request. And because we depend so heavily on SCWRP and the work that they do in supporting our regulatory decisions, I think it would be worthwhile to have one of our meetings at your facilities. If you have a meeting room available, that would be great. And then a tour of your facility, so we can learn a little bit more about what all you do.
Okay. When I got up here and I said to myself, "What's my measure of success of whether this went well?" It was actually you saying, "I want his newsletter." And I said, "If he asked me for my newsletter, I know I did well. This is better. I'd be honored to do it." Yes, okay. We have a great conference room. We don't have as fancy a table for you to sit at, but we have a great conference room, and it would be our honor to have you meet
okay.
there.
And if it doesn't meet our AAV requirements and needs, we do have OCWD's facilities close by, and so it's just down the road. I drive by your facility all the time when I take my mother to the doctor, so I'm familiar with it. So
yeah, no, okay. We do have good audio and visual capabilities.
Okay, thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much. Again, impactful and so much great information. Really appreciate it. And I particularly appreciate it for those of us that are less educated in this topic than my vice chair. vignettes and the case studies that you shared and really helped us to understand it better in practical terms. So thank you.
My pleasure. And you didn't ask, but I do have a quarterly newsletter that any of you wants.
Yes, please. We want the newsletter. One, we want it, and two, we want you to have your metric.
There you go. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So moving on to item 10, which is our executive officer's report. Jane, would you like to present?
Yes, I do. I have just a few updates to make sure that you're all aware of some of the things that we're currently working towards. Dee Dee mentioned the WQCC, so we will be attending that next week. I did want to talk a little bit about the MS4 permit renewal and where we are. I have had numerous questions about schedule and where are we added. As you recall, back in September, we had a meeting that was really well attended by multiple agencies, and we talked a lot about the discussion of our comments, and they've been verbose. And from that meeting, we were asked to provide and work with the staff to come up with some solutions. And we've done that from November 24 till April 25. We have held 9 meetings with the counties and also with our interested parties. And they have been really well attended. We're talking 70-plus people at each meeting. First, I just want to give a shout-out to Amanda Carr, Richard Boone, and Arlene Chun. They opened their facilities, and they managed those meetings, which is really a difficult thing to do a hybrid meeting, but they did it very well, and it was I really appreciate them doing that for us. It was extremely beneficial. But the discussions were well attended, but they were also very good. We did repeat a lot of talking about our comments, same comments over, but we gained a more level of understanding about where each other is intended to go with the permit. And so I think they were very much worthwhile. I think that from that we had been working on a revised permit, but some of those meetings we revised it even more. And so where the permit currently is in its state is that the revision is complete. We've responded to the comments. These are both very large documents. And we're still doing final review through our staff and through our Office of Chief Counsel. There is one decision that came out with the City and County of San Francisco versus USCPA that relates directly to this permit. I won't go into detail. It's not appropriate this time. However, it will affect the language in the permit. And so the state board, as long as, and the regional boards were working on interpreting what does that mean. We know what it means for one permit, but what does it mean for the other NPDES permit? And Eric's on the, was working with that state. So, but it will delay issuing that permit, I think, by months. It's been a rough go, but it will delay it. So I was hopeful we would be having it done this summer, but I think we're looking end of the year. And as we understand what, you know, no matter what decision is made, we're going to have to adjust the language. But once we know exactly what to do, we'll make sure that the board knows and we'll firm up our schedule at that time. But really the final thing is we're going to need to take that second permit, the second revised permit, put it out for public comment. It has significant level of changes, but it will go through formal comment period. We do plan to have a workshop, another workshop, before we go and do a public hearing again, which I think would be healthy, and then we'll bring it to a close. The other area I wanted to bring up is our Lake Elsinore Canyon Lake total maximum daily load basin plan amendment. We met in February. And we provided the input of what's included in that basin plan. City of Banning raised some concerns that were very serious concerns. We and I actually met with my staff. We went out to Banning. We saw the site. It was raining the day we were there. So we got a chance to see what level of input physically and
you know, we have our models and so forth, but it was interesting. But we had a really good meeting, and Riverside County Flood joined us, so we had some really healthy discussions. We do have a proposal that we're currently working on to stay banning until we've done some analysis, and we're going to bring that back in July. That language is going to go out for public comment, I believe, next week or shortly in the first week of May. So I feel we have a nice solution to that situation, and we can bring that basin plan to a close. And I think it's really important. This piece of work is really good. And, you know, this is some of the work that comes out of, SAPA helps us with the work. They're involved. We work with Leshwa. But it's a really fine piece of environmental work. And I know we had this issue with banning, but the actual work that was done is unique. It's stellar. It's forward thinking. I'm just really proud of it. I just want to state that publicly. So, we are coming in July. We've been working with the task force. We've been working with banning, and I think we're in a good place to bring that to close. The other area, I just want to make sure you're aware, but with the Los Angeles fires and the disposal of that waste, you know, we had talked about that they can use the municipal solid waste units. We have those solid waste units in our region. One of them is El Sobrante Landfill. They had put in that they could receive the waste. However, they have a thermal activity taking place within the landfill. It's an older landfill. It's not in the area of current disposal, but it is kind of outside in one of the older areas. We have been meeting with them and all the other regulatory agencies that cover landfills, to include Cal EPA, DTSC, Cal Recycle, EPA, the Air Board, and the local agency and CUPA. And it's kind of a high level from a regulatory standpoint because of what happened up in LA. But this is what I'm understanding and what I understand from our staff, we're not at that level of issue, but there is some data indicating high thermal activity, and the management of El Sobrante Landfill has been very responsive, and they have not received any of that LA debris. So just to make sure that that's clear. So, but we are working very closely with them, and I do believe it will get resolved. The last thing is, this is something that I've been trying to work on for quite a while, and with my team, is the office. We've done a reorganization of our office. We've had a lot of, when you're working in these programs, and you do that, you call them their budget change proposals, where you can get new staff and some staff is removed, and these things happen. Over time, you start to get an imbalance in your organization and your structure. And as we've worked through the MS4 permit, we really recognize the need to make sure that when we're developing these basin plans and these TMDLs, that we also look at what would be the tool to make sure that we can implement it properly, and because the two kind of don't fit very well together. So what we're going to do is we're going to move our MS4 staff from our one branch and put it into our planning branch, and then they'll be able to work under the same leadership and together. And we've had this imbalance. We have three divisions. We've kind of had an imbalance across those divisions, and the planning division was the least resourced. And so bringing this other group into their environment just gives them more staff time, more flexibility, and more ability to coordinate. I have been really trying to make sure that we work across our programs, because there is quite a bit of overlap that can occur, so that we kind of know what each other are doing. And I am so excited to see this occur, because I think it will make us function better. I think we'll be able to serve our customers and our dischargers to a better degree and come up with better solutions. So it's happening. We're making those moves. And just lastly, this year there was some budget reductions. We did lose three vacancies, not actual staff, but three vacancies. At the time we had to remove them, they were in our key permitting areas. So this reorganization also includes making sure that staff is moved into those key permitting positions so that we don't lose that that effort in those programs. They're really important ones that we have to keep, make sure that they're moving forward. So, yeah, so we've made some good decisions. I'm looking forward to seeing how that will be affected and played out. And that's my report. So, unless there's any questions.
Really good information. Any questions from the board members? Seeing none, I just want to really thank you and the entire team for going out personally and working with Banning. I think their testimony and concerns raised at our board meeting were very heartfelt and concerning. And so taking that extra step, knowing how stretched thin you all are, I personally greatly appreciate it. I'm sure the board does as well. So thank you.
Sure. Absolutely.
And for all the above, especially on the Racial Equity Act and the really robust outreach you're doing there. So with that, we'll move to... finishing up the executive officer's report, we'll move to board member items to discuss. Item 11, and I'll start at the far end with board member Lopez. Anything to conclude the meeting?
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I recently saw a video of the wastewater release that is going into the Tijuana River and down flowing into
yes.
the flowing into the beach area and. I know that raised a lot of concern. I was just curious, maybe perhaps someone how would inform us or give a brief recap of how it's impacting the, the whole coastal area. Because I'm sure it's not just San Diego. The water, the ocean currents move it, different places, storms and all that. So I just perhaps maybe sometime in the future, if it's appropriate,
We can definitely do that. It has been probably one of the main priorities for the San Diego Regional Board. We meet with the other EOs weekly, and the EO is actually counting the number of days that it has been occurring. And I know the city of Imperial is just the odors. It is a serious problem that's being worked on. But I will work on that, and I know I can get us an update on where it stands. Yeah. We'll do.
Thank you. Board Member Alvarado.
Thank you. I just wanted to say thank you to our guests. The presentations were amazing. We definitely want your newsletters. We want to continue reading and learning from all of you. So we want to say thank you. And I want to say special thanks to the team. The racial equity resolution and all the work that has been done makes us proud. Knowing that there's more inclusion, that there's conversations, and that we have an action plan. I really like to see the action plan and to see the involvement. So I want to thank the colleges and all of the other partners that were mentioned before for all the work that is being done with us. And, let's continue working so that our families and our communities are healthy, and this is the way to do it. Water is life, and we know that we have to improve the quality every day. And so I am very, very pleased, very happy to be part of that work. Thank you.
Yes, Board Member Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll reiterate my colleague and just thanking all of our guests today for the presentations. Thanks for staying to the end. You didn't have to, but great to hear from you all and just have the active participation in our meetings. And then I'll also reiterate again just my gratitude for being able to be a part of the Pomona College panel. And I really think this is a new wave that we can serve as trailblazers for the rest of the state with other boards and commissions about how to involve the community and really how to invigorate and educate the next generation of leaders. A lot of people don't even know about kind of the appointments process and being able to serve at this level from the regulatory perspective. So it's really an opportunity for us to educate and engage and show young people what opportunities are available for them to be leaders, maybe even earlier in their careers than we had an opportunity to do so. So, again, just grateful for the opportunity, everyone. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Thank you. Board Member Rue.
I will reiterate the comments made by my colleagues. I also want to note, and it is with sadness, the passing of someone from Orange County, Mary Eileen Mathias, who was well known in the water industry for probably over four decades. She was truly interested in everything we do with this board. I know I would talk to Mary Eileen on different occasions, and she was alert as to what we were doing. She knew the water industry backwards and forwards. She lived a really good life, very philanthropic here in Orange County. Even someone up in the city of Montclair knew Mary Eileen's charitable endeavors and what she was doing. So we appreciate her service, and we will miss her in water. To leave on a high note, some of you may or may not know that I believe it was Monday, the International Monetary Fund named California as the fourth largest economy in the world. We surpassed Japan. Our economy is $4.3 trillion. That is nothing to laugh at. For all of those who say, oh, it's Califailure, a $4.3 trillion economy is not a failure. We are a success, and we're only going to move forward and be better. We have, in the next few years, the Super Bowl will be here, the World Cup, and the Olympics. So I only expect to see greater and greater things from this wonderful state. All of us up here call home, and I'm very proud to be a native Californian. Thank you.
Thank you, Board Member Rue. Vice Chair Scandura?
Boy, that's a hard one to follow.
I know. He sets it up strong.
Yeah, thank you to all the presenters today, to the City of Santa Ana. I'm really happy to see that all six of us are here today. That's really a great thing. I also want to recognize we have our two attorneys down from Sacramento, Jennifer Fortas, and then our new attorney, Heraclio Rock, and he's going to be working with us. And I promise, but I don't know if I can guarantee we'll be nice to you. So welcome to Santa Ana, Santa Ana region.
We'll be nice, we promise. Thank you, Vice Chair Scandura. So I would just like to close as well by thanking the City of Santa Ana for hosting us today, to the staff, to the council for the use of their chambers. Greatly appreciate it. And also, for all the work that the team is doing on our racial equity priorities, I think it's really important for the residents and everyone who is a part of our region in any capacity to know that diversity, equity, and inclusion are priorities and will remain priorities for our region, for our board. And thank you for that outreach. And I really hope more students get involved so the youth of our region feel that inclusion as well. And I would just, following in Board Member Rue's remarks, request that we close today. Well, we're not going to quite close yet because we have a closed session, but when we do, that we close in the memory of Mary Eileen Mathias, who was a mentor to many and certainly a dear friend to so many and a leader in the water industry for most of her life. So thank you. With that, we will now move to closed session, and I am going to read a script here for you all. I'd like to ask, actually, I get to ask Jennifer Fordyce to announce the closed session, so the floor is yours.
All right, so the board's going to adjourn to closed session to discuss item B on the closed session list, which is consideration of the appointment of the executive officer. And definitely correct me if I'm wrong, Chair Marie, the board has no more open session items, so the closed session will be the last item on the agenda, and the meeting will be adjourn immediately after closed session, but we do have to come back and actually
officially close it.
But yeah. No one needs to wait around.
Yes.
On the Zoom, because other than adjournment, nothing really is going to happen.
Correct. So with that, we will move into closed session. Thank you so much, everybody. Okay, everyone. Thank you so much. We've just completed our closed session. So at this time, I would like to adjourn to the regular board meeting scheduled for June 13th, 2025 at 9 a.m. Please follow our website for further updates, and thank you everyone for joining us today. God bless and have a great weekend.